At 17, Chantelle McDougall was nannying for a 36-year-old man. At 20, she was pregnant with his child and swept up in his bizarre spiritual beliefs. At 27, they all disappeared.
I just wished I'd asked a lot more questions no matter what.
I'm Dominique Bayens, host of Expanse, The Nan Up 4, a story of control, manipulation and isolation. Search Expanse on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
Today it's all about the redemptive power of small dogs. My guest is John Howard. Not John Howard, the Prime Minister, not John Howard, the actor. This John Howard has lived his life pretty much outside the public eye. John ran away from home at an early age, and he fetched up in Sydney's King's Cross. And this was the cross in the late 60s, when it was full of excitement and danger and temptation. John the street kid took up petty crime, odd jobs here and there, and he was in and out of jail a few times. He had some mental health issues and problems with addiction. John was in middle age when he adopted a little dog who gave him the love and affection he'd been starved of all his life, and the idea for a business that grew into something big. Now in his 70s, this former street kid has made good money renting out car park spaces in his old neighbourhood. Hello, John.
Hi, Rich.
What kind of a child were you when you were growing up in the outer burbs of Sydney back in the day?
Quite quiet, actually. Yeah, just an avid reader. And I now know the word to be an isolator, but yeah, certainly an avid reader. And hid out in fantasy, really.
Did you have a sense of not quite fitting in from an early age?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know how that showed itself in my mind, but I kind of knew that I couldn't honestly speak with anyone around me, even though I had a twin brother and a seemingly, you know, good house full of people.
You escaped from the family home, like I said, as a teenager and fetched up in King's Cross. This was the late 60s. What was the cross like in those days?
It was fabulous. It was the end of the hippie days. Certainly the R&R days were shaping themselves up to be a fantasy life.
This is soldiers from Vietnam coming
here. Vietnam for 10 days of rest and recreation.
American soldiers?
American soldiers, yeah.
Navy people, yeah. They brought a lot of heroin into the cross with them in those days.
And that's
too.
Part of the change as well.
Did you see that change?
I saw the change. In actual fact, one of my friends, Nancy, used to work as a professional lady down towards the bourbon and beefsteak end of Darlinghurst Road. And that end was fairly much known as the working girls area who didn't use drugs. The other end, up Coconut Grove, up towards the main intersection there, were, dare I use the word, the riffraff of King's Cross at that time. Yeah.
What kind of odd jobs were you picking up to get by as a kid?
I used to buy blocks of hashish from a little coffee lounge on the way to Whiskey Go-Go and cut them up and sell them to people at Whiskey Go-Go. And Nancy gave me a place to live as long as I cleaned up after her each customer, emptied the bins, made the bed, that kind of stuff, you know. So I would steal stuff on order. You know?
What does that mean?
It was like, in actual fact, it was my brother who started me on this. He had a two-door Valiant and he had an accident and he asked me to steal the same model and he would pay for particular parts. And I became known as a good car thief, really.
What were you when you were doing this, John?
Most probably 15, I guess, 16.
This was the heyday of Abe Saffron when he ran most of the sex trade in King's Cross. Did you ever see him about the place?
I saw him, met him a number of times at the Bourbon and Beefsteak when I worked there. He always impressed me as a quiet, kind of genuine kind of man, you know, just, you know, unobtrusive.
He didn't carry an air of menace about him or anything like that?
Not for me, no. I can remember one meeting, it was in the middle room of the Bourbon and Beefsteak and he was meeting with Bernie Horton, the guy, the Texan who owned the Bourbon and Beefsteak. And it was just like two old blokes just having a coffee and just sitting there chatting, and it was just like harmless as. Bernie was a kind of father figure to me, and I just thought, yeah, these are two people in my lives. Could have been a father and an uncle.
Tell me about some of the distinctive characters from the Cross in those days. Tell me about One-Armed Ernie.
One-Armed Ernie had obviously one arm, and he was a bouncer at, I think it was the Coconut Grove.
A bouncer with one arm?
With one arm, but you wouldn't not cross him. It was just like he could really use his one arm. And my twin worked at the club. This was before the Palace Disco opened up, where the railway station is now. And he had a fierce reputation, but he was a nice guy. He just a nice, you know, unobtrusive kind of guy.
What was the police presence like at the time?
Corrupt. Oh, hang on. Did I say corrupt? But yeah.
I think that's a matter of public record.
Yeah, that is public record. Because they all used to drink at the Bourbon and Beefsteak, and you had Roger Rogerson getting around the 21 squad. I was more liable to be bashed and arrested because I was a pest. I wasn't a criminal as such. I knew these people and I did favours for different people, but I wasn't, you know, a hardened criminal. I was just like a nuisance, a little guy just trying to react and get on.
After a couple of years, your parents had migrated to Australia from the UK.
Yeah.
They re-migrated back to the UK, and you went to visit them in the UK. Were they pleased to see you?
Not particularly, no. It, in actual fact, I think it was my first prison sentence, and my mother came out to Long Bay, and my mother said, blah, 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 we've decided to move back, and pretty much you're the reason for that. And they were going to move back the next week. And I can vividly remember that each week, because Long Bay was under the flight path, looking up at each plane that was flying over and thinking, I wonder if they're on there. That's what I can remember.
You got into major trouble in the Cross.
Yeah.
In a very nasty situation in the Cross. Can you tell me what happened?
Yeah, there was a couple psychopaths in their own way, and one of them, the husband, knew that I was friends with someone, and he asked me to invite along for a coffee down to a brothel in Kellett Street, which I did, non-thinking. And we no sooner walked in the room than he attempted to kill her.
How did he attempt to kill her?
He started hitting her close fists and then pushing her face through the window, and I was able to pull him off. His wife came in, she pulled him off. And I took the woman out and we got an ambulance and I just kind of melted into the background and disappeared.
What happened when the police arrived?
I wasn't there when the police arrived, but within days he got arrested. She had obviously gone to hospital and spoken about what had happened. He got arrested. My name was mentioned. I got arrested.
Were you charged with anything?
I do remember the police saying that I would be charged with accessory before and after the fact of attempted murder if I didn't go witness against this guy.
And were you afraid to be a witness against this guy?
Absolutely. The guy was nuts. So it went to court, and I believe I was declared a hostile witness because I was caught between a rock and a hard place. I was going to be either charged with accessory before and after the fact of attempted murder, or I had this nutcase on my case, you know, so I don't think I was charged, therefore I was released or free to go, and I devised a plan.
What was your plan?
My plan was that he was charged and refused bail initially. Then he went to court again and was given, I think from memory, a $5,000 bail.
Oh, no. Yeah. He was let out on bail, this guy?
No, he wasn't, but he's... girlfriend, she went out and started earning money working as a working girl to raise the bail money, and I knew where she lived, and it was getting closer, I thought getting closer and closer to her getting the bail money, him getting out, me getting killed. So I hid in the firewell of the building that, I'm not proud of this, hid in the firewell of the building where she lived and robbed her. Didn't hurt her, anything like that, but just robbed her of her takings and left town.
How did you get out of town?
I stole a car.
And where were you heading?
I had an idea, which I thought was a good idea, was to start a hippie commune on Moreton Island.
That's about as different as you can get from the Cross,
right.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
In Moreton Island in Queensland?
Yeah.
Right. And how far did you get in this stolen car?
I got as far as Taree. and I had breakfast, which consisted, I think it was chocolate milk, and I finished with a carton. I threw the carton out the window of the car and I got pulled up and got arrested for car stealing. I don't know if I was arrested for littering, but anyway, whatever.
Where did the police take
you? They took me to a place about 10 kilometres outside of Taree.
Like a watch house or something?
It was like a police and court compound. And they had either two or four prison cells, and they were attached to the police station, and it was attached to the courthouse.
So you're in fear of your life still. And if you're going to be sent to prison, then you're in, and you're in the same prison as this man, you'd be in real strife.
Yeah, but I was up the coast and he was in Sydney. But it was Christmas period. It was really, really hot. And they had a half a trapdoor in the prison cell door. And I asked the prison officer, because of the heat, to keep the flap open. I stuck my head through late at night and figured if I can get my head through, I can get my whole body through.
So you're a pretty small guy. Were you able to do that?
Yeah, I was able to do that.
Get your whole body out of that the hatch there.
I stripped off. I tied my clothes to my ankle. I climbed through. I got into the courtyard. It had bars and chicken wire going into the walls. And right in the corner where there was some wood bedding, you slept on wood slats. And they had these wood slats standing against the corner. And I got a broom and I pulled out the chicken wire and I could just fit my head in between the prison bars in the roof of the courtyard and got out.
Where did you go once you escaped from this remand centre?
I hitchhiked to Taree and then I hitchhiked from Taree to Newcastle. Was picked up by a guy in a Ford Star Fairlane who sexually assaulted me and got out at Newcastle, got a train to Sydney and moved into a crash pad down in Woolloomooloo.
Oh, what state were you in?
Not good. It was a reaction. I lived in a reactionary state most of my life.
Reacting to whatever was happening?
To whatever came. You know, like a pinball, when you pull back the pinball? That's how I was. It was just like this ball bouncing from one incident to another incident, you know?
Did that psychopath catch up with you?
Yeah, he did. He pulled exactly the same trick. He asked a friend of mine, this is why I was on the run. I was on the run, I think, for less than a bit under a week. But in that time, he had heard I was back in Sydney and he'd asked a friend of mine to contact me and say, look, I've got a safe place for you to hide out. So I went into this room and there's the psychopath and his wife there.
What did he do with you once he got hold of you?
Well, he started to bash me and then he started to push, you know, smash my head through the window and whatnot. But in doing so, he lost his grip and it was 1.5 stories up, but there was a cement kind of pillar outside. And so I took the opportunity and I kind of jumped and was half pushed out the window and landed on top of the pillar and fell to the ground and then just took off.
So where did the police find you eventually?
In the crash pad in Woolloomooloo.
But yeah. You'd escaped custody at this point.
I'd escaped custody. And police don't like people escaping from custody. True then, would even guess true now. They get into trouble if that happens. Someone's let the team down. And so I was arrested at gunpoint and taken before court. Got a prison sentence for that. Got a prison sentence for the car.
So you're like 19 or 20 at this point or thereabouts?
I guess thereabouts.
So you're in prison at this stage, and you're a smaller guy, like you said.
Yeah.
How vulnerable were you to other prisoners at that point?
Pretty vulnerable. I didn't know how to fight. I would react, and I knew what was going to happen. So I declared myself as a non-associate.
What does that mean?
It means that you didn't associate with other people, and generally gay people would become non-associate in fear of rape and this kind of stuff.
What, so you'd have to be sequestered from the other prisoners?
Absolutely. And that's what I did.
So were you in solitary at that point?
16 hours a day I was in a cell by myself. Yeah. In the MRP and the Central Industrial Prison.
Once you got out of prison, you got a job with P&O? What was the job?
It was a steward, a dining room steward. I was on the Oriana, I believe, the old Oriana.
And that took you all over the world. There'd be all these kind of stopovers in the Pacific. Tell me about how you managed to pick yourself up an interesting pet in Samoa.
Well, it's not just me, to be fair. It was like, I mean, we were pretty kind of a loose bunch at that time.
You and the other dining stewards.
Yeah, and we're in a boat port where people came out from the island with, you know, baskets of this and that and souvenirs, and they would swap them for money or whatever, you know. So we devised a plan and we sold a big industrial box of, I think it was cornflakes from the galley, and we lowered down the cornflakes and all they had to offer was this, I guess it was a baby shark.
It was baby shark?
A live baby shark.
What was it in?
It was in one of those palm basket. Right. Kind of thing.
You hoisted up a baby shark.
A baby shark.
What was wriggling in this basket, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and realised, what have we done here? We've got no place to put this. What are we going to do with it?
I also have to say, they're not the most affectionate of pets, the shark.
No, we didn't get too close to it.
But what did you do with it?
We put it in one of these sinks in the galley, in the kitchen in the galley. And then we just became onto our next adventure. We just kind of dissipated and forgot all about the shark.
What did you do with it in the end?
It remained there until it was discovered.
Right, and then you threw it overboard or something?
No, we didn't go near it. It was just like put somewhere, I guess, in P&O's files is found in a kitchen baby shark.
How was it you managed to get yourself kicked out of Samoa once?
Oh, we crashed, again. Look, we were pretty much young. We were, you know, young and just, you know, world's our oyster and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And we rented a car and I think it was, I'm pretty sure it was under my name. And we were playing this game, which seemed to be big at the time, where the passenger would slide across to the driver's seat as the driver got out the car window and went across the roof of the car and then into the passenger window. And you would do this kind of round robin thing.
You keep doing it?
Right. You keep doing it, yeah. And we crashed into a side of a bridge. So we scurried back to the ship as quickly as we could. The car was reported, and just as the ship was sailing, the car rental place contacted the ship, the purser, and my name was on the lease agreement. So I was called before the acting purser and said, you're not to get off in this port ever again.
What do you think going through the mind of someone who's a young guy who's doing that sort of thing?
Not much.
Well, there's the thrill and the laughter that comes from having accomplished it. But is there some suicidal impulse there as well, do you think?
Not in my mind. It was just like young, you know, you're going to live forever, you know, let's do stuff, yeah.
At this time in your 20s, you got a job at the Bourbon and Beefsteak restaurant in Sydney that was set up to serve American servicemen. What did that job do for you, John?
It changed my life.
How did it do that?
I'd just been released from prison. I was living in a prisoner's halfway house over at Glebe, and somehow or other I knew for the first time possibly in my life that if I didn't change my ways, right, I would within weeks land back in prison. So I stole a newspaper and a carton of milk from Woolworths at Town Hall. I sat in Hyde Park. I went through the job ads in the newspaper. I got a job as a trainee bartender at the Bourbon and Beefsteak, and I moved into the Rex Hotel. And the structure of that restaurant was such that it was just like a home to me. It was, you know, I had a pretty much for the first time what felt like a real home to me.
You started drinking very heavily at some point. Was that while you were working there?
I picked up my first drink at the International Bar at the Rex Hotel.
What, you'd avoided the drink until then?
Yeah, absolutely. I may have had a can of KB or you know, I'd taken some LSD once. I'd smoked hashish. I'd had one Buddha stick and got terribly sick, so I didn't try it again. But it wasn't part of my life up until that Bourbon and Beefsteak time.
And how quickly did that get out of control?
It became a needed thing pretty much every day. It was the missing ingredient in my life. It was how it felt. I survived it, but I quickly became a daily drinker, and I drank for the next X amount of years, at the end of my drinking, I was a park bench wino. That's the reality of it. Without a park bench, I just didn't like people. No, I was fearful of people, more to the point. I lived in a back lane. The only reason I came out of that lane was to get more alcohol. And I just became this kind of human flotsam jetsam of back lanes around Surrey Hills and Chinatown.
Who was it that pulled you out of that?
It's funny. I've been living in this lane. I still don't know for how long I've been living in this lane, but I've been living in this lane for a while, and it wasn't a well-used lane, but if someone were to walk or drive through it, I would close my eyes and I would keep as still as I possibly could. And I would hide my head in the brickwork and I would wait for the person or the car to go past. And this particular day it didn't. A car came in. I did that procedure. I closed my eyes, kept it still. And this car stopped behind me. And I heard footprints come up behind me. And this guy said, mate, he said, are you okay? He was a taxi driver. He's a taxi driver taking a shortcut. And he was a sober member of a like a fellowship.
What was he able to do for you, John?
He put me in his taxi and he took me to a bottle shop. He bought me a flask of something and then took me to, there was a McKinnon detox unit at that time, and they took a look at me and called an ambulance. Yeah. And I was pretty, I sometimes share that I was weeks away from passing away, and that's the truth of it. I was 7 stone. I found a bottle of alcohol and I'd broken the top off, stuck it in my mouth to drink it, ripped the top of my mouth open. So I had infections in my top of my mouth. I'd had infections in my scalp, ripped tendons in my arm. I'd been bashed and had a couple of broken ribs. I walked sideways. I had protruding stomach. I had DTs. I had electric fleas. I was weeks away from passing away.
Do you remember much of this, or is this stuff people have had to tell you after the fact?
I remember it over the years. But it's funny, I rediscovered that lane. For a while now, I would, every year or so, on an anniversary, I'd go down there and just kind of remember and think with gratitude how far I've come.
Where were you sent to recover after you were patched up by the hospital?
I was in Royal Prince Alfred getting physically patched up, and then I was sent for some brain function tests over at the hospital at Randwick. And they assessed me as being, I believe, in early stages of Korsakoff syndrome.
What's that?
It's like a wet brain. It's where, for me anyway, now I'm not a doctor, obviously, so I wouldn't know whether I was medically, that was a diagnosis, but it'd be things like I would forget my own name.
Oh, really? So it was like incipient brain damage in other words, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. One of the most clear things that I remember, at one stage throughout that whole process, I was given a blank sickness benefits form, and I was asked to sign it. And I looked at the form, and I looked at the pen, and I kind of knew what they were, but I didn't know how to work them. And it was just like the simplest of things. And I wasn't stupid, but I just really did not know how to make them work.
Was that distressing, or were you beyond feeling distressed at that point?
It was frustrating and, distressing. But then my whole life, seemingly up to that point, particularly the last 10 years of it, was such that I was, I was the flotsam and jetsam. I was just surviving.
How were you managing to remember things if your brain wasn't working too well at that time? Were you jotting things down or something?
Yeah. Well, I went back to McKinnon. They sent me to an alcohol-related brain damage unit in Rozelle Hospital grounds. And they gave some of us, I still can't remember this, they gave some of us a notepad and pencil, not immediately so. I must have been there 3 months or so before that happened.
What kind of things would you write on that notepad?
Your name, the next meal time, what bed number you sat at or you went to bed in, what day it was. They had a notice board in the dining room, and I can vividly remember this. That they one day they asked me to just to put the date, like the number one, the month, the year. And I got the date right, but I didn't know the month or the year. And I just burst into tears. It was just like I knew that I should know, but I didn't.
But you've recovered. I mean, you well, largely recovered. We're talking just fine at the moment, and you're remembering things. Was that a long, slow process of recovery?
It was a long, slow process. I carried a notebook and pencil with me, certainly for the first 8 years, But this was pre-internet as well. And I would write down bus numbers and bus stops that I had to catch a bus to. I used to go to meetings with like-minded people and I might need to catch the 401 bus to do that. And I would write down 401 bus at such and such a time. And that way I would know the next time on the Thursday I would catch that bus to that meeting.
Do you still do that as a kind of a checklist for yourself, just with a much more sophisticated one now?
I love to do check-off lists. I can write, okay, these are the jobs, and I love to tick them off.
So you moved into a housing cooperative Sydney suburb of Annandale. What was this cooperative? Tell me about it.
It was called Ningana, and it was an ex-immigration department housing, and there was 50-odd studio apartments, and it was run by a group of lesbian separatists.
And they put you in there as an ex-crim.
Yeah, but I didn't appear as an ex-crim. Appeared as a fractured, harmless human being struggling to stay alive.
You nonetheless had your own studio apartment. I just wonder what that was like for you to have a proper place to live in after all
this. It was fantastic. It was fantastic. I just look, you know, I mean, it was just like I found furniture and I bought little bits for some vinnies and that kind of stuff. But it was a fantastic time in my life.
Did you think this is how I should be living? Is that what the thought was, rather than the wilder life you'd pursued as a kid?
What it felt like was I was knee-deep in quicksand and the apartment was giving me the ability to walk out of that quicksand slowly. I had to learn to cook. So I cooked chili con carne and I would have chili con carne for a fortnight. Because I'd freeze it. And then I would go to those meetings, like-minded people, and we'd contribute toward the rent. And, you know, I can remember all I'm having to contribute is 50 cents. That was it.
So but, living like a, I suppose, what we'd call, quote-unquote, a normal person was a bit like an undiscovered country for you.
Oh, absolutely. It wasn't. I was most probably 43, 44 before I realised that you stood to the left on an escalator to allow people to go past and that I really believed up until then that women didn't pass wind. I mean, no idea at all.
So you got some jobs. What kind of jobs were you able to get at that stage?
Well, I was on a 10-year disability support pension and Department of Housing emergency waiting list plus another housing co-op thing. I moved house into Ward Avenue in Potts Point.
So you moved back into the Cross?
Into the Cross after a couple of years of not being there. And
I have to ask why. Why did you move back to the Cross, given it's your home? Even though it's the site of your downfall, it was...
Oh, yeah, but it was just like it would always be my home since 13, 14. It was just like this is my home. I went through the Wentworth Courier and I found that a budget hotel in Springfield Avenue called the Springfield Lodge was advertising for a night manager, and I use that word loosely.
See, I remember in the 80s and 90s, a lot of touring bands used to stay there. I think I might have stayed there a couple of times myself.
Absolutely, just three doors down from the Mansell Room. And I can remember the day I got the job. I went in there. I'd spent weeks on a resume filling in the years gaps that just didn't exist. And there was a small Greek man standing behind the counter talking with the receptionist, and there was a guy sitting on the sofa in the foyer waiting to see the manager. I walked past him, went up to the counter and said, "I'm here to apply for a job." The little Greek guy said, "Yeah, just come in and I want to have a chat with you." Well, he was the owner and he said, "Yeah, fine." You know, he interviewed me and said, "Fine, you can have the job." And then he went out and told the guy that had been sitting in the foyer waiting to be interviewed that the job was filled.
So King's Cross was changing at that time.
Absolutely.
I moved up from Melbourne to live in Potts Point, the Cross, around about that time. And I remember that changeover period as it was becoming gentrified.
Like
old bikey bars were being shut down and replaced by smart restaurants, that kind of thing. What did you think about all that as it was going on?
It was far better than what it had been previously. As in, it was the gangster wars, it was those kind of King Hit kind of... I used to walk one block from where I lived in Ward Avenue to Springfield Lodge, and I would have to remind myself, no eye contact, you know, just keep your head down, walk home.
I remember it was at 3 a.m. on a Saturday night or Sunday morning. That's when you'd see cars cruising around the neighbourhood of young men who'd come into the Cross and hadn't got what they wanted and now were just looking for someone's head to beat in.
Absolutely. And they were the unpredictable ones because the people who lived there knew each other.
Yeah.
But it was the unpredictable ones that were the ones to look out for.
So tell me, John, how was it you got your first puppy at this time?
Oh, Sonny, my little toy poodle. I had met a B&D mistress.
What, a dominatrix?
A dominatrix.
Yes.
And I wasn't a client at all, but I had met and we seemed to get on well. And we'd known each other for about a year and we got along really well. And she invited me over for a cup of tea one day. So I went over for a cup of tea and two of her dogs had had puppies a couple of days before. And there was these two little four-day-old puppies just playing on the floor, you know, a little black one and a little white toy poodle. And combined together, they were about the size of a $5 note. They were like these kind of big witchetty grubs.
And what did it feel like to hold one of them?
Well, I picked up the white one and he squealed and I, terrified, I put him back with his mum and picked up the black one and he began to squeal. But as I stroked him, he just went to sleep in my hand and I just fell in love. You know, it was just like this little being is trusting me to fall asleep, to trust me enough to fall asleep in my hand. And my friend saw this and she said, look, she said, I'll make sure he gets all his needles and you're quite welcome to visit 2-3 times a week and leave an old T-shirt and get him used to your scent and your sound and your smell and all that kind of stuff. And when he's 8 weeks old, you can take him home. He's all yours. He was a turning point in my life, you know.
How so? I mean, in the sense of your understanding of love and affection and trust.
There was very little of that in my life. It was more of a reaction. I did some research on my history as such, and I've got a document under the Freedom of Information Act which shows a pre-release report from one of the boys' homes that I was sent to. And I love my mother, and she's passed away and she absolutely did the best that she could. But she had her own history. And in this pre-release report, she said that she couldn't have John at home because they'd just put a fridge on hire purchase and they couldn't afford both the fridge and John. So it's just like it wasn't an overexpression of love and affection. It was there, no doubt, but I didn't kind of get the feeling of it. But this puppy absolutely gave me the feeling of it.
You said it was only after you went to the doctor around about this time, you were around about 45, that you could reflect on what had happened to you as a child, because we haven't really talked about that. What happened on that visit to the doctor?
I'd made a decision that she would know all about my history, you know. It felt the right thing to do. It was she who discovered that I had hepatitis C. I didn't know that until I visited hers. But I was talking with her one day about, I don't know, something or other, and I said, no, by the way, I've got brittle bones. And she said, well, no, what makes you think you've got brittle bones? And I said, well, you know, as child growing up, you know, I always seem to have broken arms or broken nose or this, that or the other. And she queried me a little bit more and I came to the understanding and the Freedom of Information documents and my elder sister has validated this verbally for me. that my father, who was a good man, and I'm a lot like my father, and he didn't drink. Possibly he should have, because the way his uncomfortability, his unease with himself came out was in violence.
Violence against you?
Yeah. And I was the youngest person in the family, so it was fairly easy to do that.
He's breaking the bones of a little boy.
Yeah. We went along to see the Sound of Music in George Street, and we're getting back into the 64 Ford Falcon at the markets there, and there was a broken pool cue in the gutter in the front of the car. And he put it in the car, and I kind of instinctively knew what it was going to be for, and that's what it was for. So it wasn't until I was about 45 that I recognised that broken bones weren't an indication of affection.
What makes you say he's nonetheless a good man? In what sense is he a good man?
Okay. A photo that I have showed him as a street kid, and he stood no chance at all. He was a street kid in London, in between the walls, you know, and yet he made himself into something. He served his country in the Second World War. And it sounds so trite, but I know that he did the best that he could. Fact is, in areas, he did a terrible job, but that's the best that he could. And if I'm to blame him for the bad stuff, I need to also own the good stuff that he gave me. He gave me a sense of humour. He gave me a willingness to work hard. And I don't know if this is a good thing, but he gave me his looks, you know. It's funny because it's my grandfather, who I only met once, and he was drunk in London, and he was violent as. And my grandfather was 84 years old and was kicked out of his council flat in London by his alcoholic wife because she suspected him of having an affair with a woman down the hall. And my father is exactly like his father, and I'm exactly like my father.
So you've done the research now, and you can see how trauma and violence cascades down through the generations, from one generation to the next, to the next, to the
next. Hurt people hurt people.
Have you tried not to do that yourself?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It comes out sideways, not in violence, but as in kind of inward self-hatred. As in not trusting myself, as in like a false modesty, a kind of a pretend humility. I counter that by trying to help others and just generally living a principled life is how I counter that.
So having Sonny in your life then, and he's your constant companion, tell me how being with Sonny launched you into a whole different line of work.
They say animals change your life. Well, he did. It was a Saturday. I brought him home in front of King's Cross Police Station. There is a little park, and they had a little kind of community kind of concert or singer in the park. There was a bunch of us, most probably, I don't know, 50, 60 people sitting on the grass listening to this little concert. Now, I was broke as a church mouse, so I'd researched in the 8 weeks how you feed dogs, how you groom them, how you train them. You know, I had two books on, I got two books from the library on dogs' names. You know, I mean, I really, really brought my obsessive nature to this dog. And anyway, the big day came. I went to the park, was sitting there on the grass, listening to the concert, and they had an intermission. And in the intermission, my little dog, he's 8 weeks old, toy poodle puppy, and everyone's oohing and ahhing him. And he went around the front between the performers and the people sitting on the grass, and he had a poo in front of everyone. Now,
see, little toy poodles aren't supposed to do that, are they?
Absolutely. They're supposed to, you know,
it's an animal, quietly and privately.
Yeah,
yeah, right. So this dog has done this in front of everyone. What did that make you think?
Well, I'd researched everything there was about dogs except that particular end of
right.
things, you know. And this phrase came to my mind of again, a man that I really did admire. And one of his favourite phrases was, in life, one's job is to keep one side of the street clean. And that's the only phrase that was going through my mind. So I borrowed a tissue I picked up after my dog, made a mental note to go out looking just for something to pick up after my dog. Now, this is 28 years ago, I guess. So I went out the next day, and what I saw I didn't like. There were plastic pooper scoopers and brown paper bags. So I carried a notebook still with me. I made some notes, and I kept looking and making notes. And I ended up designing a lemon-scented poo bag for dogs.
Now, I think there'll be a lot of people listening who are really shocked to know that poo bags haven't been around forever. And I can remember a time before doggy poo bags. I can remember the pooper scooper era and all of that, which often leaves a kind of a pretty disgusting mess on the scooper.
Yeah.
It's an unsatisfactory solution.
Absolutely.
So what you came up with the idea to manufacture doggy poo bags?
And to a particular design. They had to be thick enough that you didn't see what you were picking up. You didn't get a sense of what you were picking up. You didn't get a sense that you put your fingers through the bag. They had to be lemon scented. Or lavender scented, I think I looked at as well. At that stage, biodegradable wasn't a factor in life. So the best that I could come up with was recycled plastic. They had to be packaged that even I could afford them. So they were packaged with a rubber band. 35 bags to a roll, held together with a rubber band, 50 rolls to a box. And I looked for manufacturers in Australia to do it. Financially not viable. I went to the Chinese Trade Embassy. Again, it was pre-internet. The Chinese Trade Embassy down in near the Royal Prince Alfred Hospital, actually, and asked to speak to someone there, got three addresses of plastic bag manufacturers in China. I wrote to those three plastic bag manufacturers, sent them samples of what I would like, the thickness of what I would like, the size of what I like, the shape, blah, blah, blah. Borrowed $500 and bought my first 10 boxes of my own designed lemon-scented poo bags for dogs.
Now, it's a matter of public record that this business took off. It just absolutely took off. Was it hard to supply, to meet the demand for these poo bags once people became aware of them?
There was... No, because I loved what I was doing, and I was passionate about plastic bags, picking up dog shit. But anyway, I was passionate about it and kept pace and kept feeding the business. And at one stage, it was Pet Barn used to say to me quite often, actually, that it was in their first 10 top sellers. And at one stage in May, I forgot what year, but in May, one year, they ordered $15,000 worth of me.
So with that business, you were able to save up money from that and get a mortgage on a flat. You're able to move in there with Sonny. And then you invest in car park spaces. The business is doing well. You're able to buy one, rent them out, buy some more, rent them out. You've done extremely well. And you've now live in this beautiful apartment with a view of Sydney Harbour.
Richard, you're exaggerating a bit. But I have more than glimpses of Rushcutters Bay and Sydney Harbour. It's my own apartment. I have in the same building three car spaces. I have a garage down the street. I have a storeroom down the street. You know, I have a good life.
You've done very well. I mean, you own your own place. You own these car park spaces. You've got income from them. Does it feel secure? Do you ever lose that feeling of insecurity that you have from being a former street kid?
I don't think I do. If I live a careful, principled life, and as long as I don't go back to old habits, I haven't had a drink for 35 and a half years. There's no doubt in my mind that if I were to have a drink today, within months I would lose a lot, and easily within months I'd most probably be once again in the back lane.
You'd say you live a principled life. What kind of principles do you try to stick to as best you can?
I try and be as real as possible. I try and keep my ego out of things as much as possible, unsuccessfully so, I might add. I try and be honest. If I'm not being honest, I need to clarify and get clear on that. And I think of a situation only a few months ago where I said something and it was foolish. It was unthinking. And I immediately had to say to the person, look, that was a lie. I didn't mean that. I try and keep a willingness to help another. I try and keep an open-mindedness about myself, you know. I do a daily reflections each day on how I behave during the day. And they're not all clean and clear. I mean, you know, particularly when I was delivering my poo bags, it was just, I drove a white van in Sydney traffic. And I don't know if you've seen white van drivers in Sydney traffic. They're terrible, you know. Well, I was anyway. And I used to bib the horn at everyone and cut and weave and cut people off. And I was saying to a friend of mine, a dear friend of mine, that, look, you know, I have a problem whenever I get in traffic and get frustrated. I bib my horn a lot. And he said, what about just trying to hand it over? Just, you know, just try and let go of it. And I tried to let go of it and it worked for a short while. and then the bibbing of the horn came back into it. And there was a prayer called the Serenity Prayer. And I can remember I cut out the Serenity Prayer and I pasted it on my steering wheel. So every time I went to bib the horn, I would look at the Serenity Prayer and think, no, okay, change the behaviour. But eventually the horn bibbing came back into it. So in the end, I just disconnected the horn.
There's a profound moral lesson in that, and I'm not entirely sure what it is.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, that sounds like a great idea. Just finally, Sonny passed away a while back. What kind of a doggy do you have in your life now?
He turned 6 yesterday. He's a rescue toy poodle, 4 kilograms. He's a joy. He's just the sweetest little boy. I mean, all animals are great, tremendous and terrific. But, you know, what's that old Chinese proverb? There's 2 types of dog in this world, toy poodles and others. Exactly that. You know, he's just a little bundle of love and joy.
Thank you for sharing your amazing story today. It's been such a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Richard.
Conversations with Richard Feidler.
Making a million conversations stick to the wall so the words won't clutter anymore.
Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Or go to abc.net.au/conversations.
Today's conversation with John Howard was made on the lands of the Gadigal people. Producer is Alice Moldovan. Executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.